Welcome to episode 44 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and I am recording this a little bit early because we have a very angry young lady bearing down towards Florida named Irma, and I'm going to have to go to the station in a moment and be the crew that rides it out. So this week, I really wanted to delve into the world of eye health and vision. This is an area that we really don't discuss very much anywhere in the fire service specifically, and the military, we touch on hearing a lot because of the noise of the sirens and the weapons and all those things. But eye health, vision as an obstacle getting into the career, how to change your vision, how to protect your eyes themselves. This is an area that, aside from you need to wear safety glasses, we just don't touch on at all. So this week's guest is Dr. Michael Lang. He's an optometrist here in Central Florida. Very well respected nationally and internationally, also a nutritionist and a psychology major. So a very interesting perspective on overall health rather than focusing just on the eyeballs themselves. So we delve into my story, which is basically I was told as a young man in England, you can never be a firefighter because you're colorblind. Absolute BS. So we'll talk about that story. And we're going to come up with some solutions for people that have things like that, the trip hazards as far as entering the profession. We're going to talk about how to maintain your eye health, not just with corrective lenses and those kind of things, but also nutrition, hydration areas there. So that's going to tie into the overall health. We're going to talk about how to protect your eyes, you know, what kind of products are out there, what to look for if you're in certain fields. And then we delve into a number of other things from A2 milk to nutrition, obesity in the U.S., so this was a great conversation I had face-to-face with Dr. Lang in his office. So I'm going to keep this intro short. I'm going to go pack my bag and drive south when everyone's driving north. Just before I leave, don't forget, rate us on iTunes, share an episode, be part of the solution of spreading each and one of these incredible episodes around the planet. So without further ado, I introduce to you Dr. Michael Lang. Enjoy. Welcome to Behind the Shield, Dr. Lang. How are you doing?
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. We are sitting here about 2 or 3 days from Hurricane Irma showing up. So I think the whole state of Florida is wondering what the hell is going to go on. But all right. So I want to kind of paint the picture before we delve into eyes and the nutrition, all the other things that we're going to talk about. Can you give me a background, where you were born, what your family unit was like?
Right. Absolutely. So I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana. September 15th, 1961. I'm 55 years old now. My dad's a rheumatologist, so I came from a medical background. And I actually was racing motocross at a competitive age. Started out about 10 years of age. I rode the Mini Bike Nationals, and I went up and started riding 125 Expert. And very competitive. I ended up in the Grand National Championship. Broke my leg and my back. Broke my leg in 5 places. Broke my back, ended my motocross career at 19 years of age. And so then I started thinking, well, I got to go to college. And I actually was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. And my dad, being a rheumatologist, said, well, you know, that's a lot of school. And, I mean, we were going to think about 15 years more of school, you know, with college, and or even more fellowship, training, residency. So I just don't know if I want to do that. So then I started thinking about optometry. And my dad said, that's a good profession. So I ended up going to optometry school. And that's how I ended up going to optometry. I wanted to do something to help people. I wanted to be in the health profession, but I didn't want to go 16 years of school. So, you know, I went 4 years of college, got a degree in psychology. Then I got another degree in physiological optics. Then I went away to optometry school for 4 years. And then I also became a certified nutritional specialist after the fact at the American College of Nutrition. And I did that because I was tired of seeing my patients really age right before my eye, age very rapidly, macular degeneration, cataracts, glaucoma. And so I started working with nutrition and started seeing how if we adjusted their diet and adjusted the supplements they were taking, that we could actually slow down the aging process in the eye and thus the entire body. And then I started my own vitamin company called Fortify Vitamins, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more. But that's how I kind of got interested in the field. The motocross accident triggered me to go to college. Because, heck, I wasn't going to go to college. I was going to be the next, you know, world champion, Bob Hurricane Hanna. And that went by the wayside. But now I'm racing cars.
Brilliant. Yeah, a little safer than a motorbike, though.
Yep. Four wheels on the ground and a roll cage.
So you said the first area you went into was psychology. Why did you choose that on the way to optometry school?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. You have to pick something in the sciences that are going to enable you to get all your prerequisites. Your prerequisites are very hard. I mean, they're physics and chemistry, organic chemistry, calculus, trigonometry, all sorts of biologies, and so and psychology. And so I didn't love biology. I didn't love chemistry, but I really liked psychology. I really liked, understanding why people react the way they do, why people act the way they do. And so I that's why I got my degree in psychology. Now, for people that are listening out there, don't go into psychology if you think you're going to make a lot of money, because with a degree at a BS level in psychology, you cannot get a job and make anything. You have to go into the master's program or your PhD and become a clinical psychologist. So that was just a stepping ground to get my prerequisites done and to get a degree so I could get into optometry school.
Okay. Now, just to kind of educate the listeners, I'm aware of how optometry schools are in the U.S. because my wife is an optician and she's on her route. And she used to work with you, and she's on a route to optometry school. The prereqs are insane, the high-level math that they need, the Rain Man stuff to go in there. But secondly, it's kind of unique, and if you could tell us a little bit more about it, there's only a certain number of schools in the whole of the U.S., aren't there? Roughly how many are there?
Well, optometry school is very competitive. I mean, it's tougher to get into optometry school, really, than medical school. Because you think about medical school, there's, five or six, seven, or even more, depending on the state medical schools per state. And optometry school, I mean, I think there's 17 or 18 optometry schools in the entire country. And so there's a lot of people that want to become optometrists because it's a four-year program after college. You know, you can make a lot of money. It's good money. You're helping people. And depending on the state, you can do eye surgery. You can prescribe any medication, orals or topicals now. Optometry has really gone into that next realm and expanded their scope. I really think an optometric physician or an optometrist is your gatekeeper, your primary eye care physician. And they'll see you for everything from glaucoma treatment and pink eye and corneal lacerations to stye removal, even laser procedures. And then when you need, major surgery, you would go to the ophthalmologist that is fellowship trained in that arena. So a retina specialist for retinal surgery, a corneal specialist for corneal surgery, oculoplastics for, plastic procedures. So ophthalmology has become very specialized. It's very rare you see a general ophthalmologist anymore because the optometrist has really taken over that whole realm of eye care and are trained very well at doing it.
Right. Now, we only have one here in Florida, and that's Nova down in Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
Do you see, and this is for Becky as well, do you see another one opening up in the state of Florida anytime soon?
I've heard rumors about, opening in Tallahassee, opening in Gainesville, Orlando, Tampa. But as far as I know, they're rumors.
Okay, because that'd be a long drive when she gets into school. But that's a whole separate thing. All right, so you weren't able to do motocross. So while you were, transitioning through school, did you take up any other sports instead?
Yeah, I actually got into road biking and mountain biking, triathlons. I competed in a lot of that. But mountain biking is really one of my passions. And road biking, and now I'm doing recumbent biking as well. Because now at 55, I'm starting to develop a little degenerative arthritis, especially my back, my neck, and my knee. And, the triathlon bikes, you're bent over, almost in a question mark position. And if you're going for a 50-mile bike ride, I got some lower back pain and neck pain after being in that position that long period of time. So I went to a carbon fiber recumbent bicycle. And, you sit back, it's almost like in a lazy boy, and it hits different muscle groups and hits your glutes, your calves, your thighs, even better than road biking does. It's pretty amazing. And now it's interesting when we think about this because, being a male, we got to be concerned at 55 years of age about prostate issues, okay? And so when I'm riking, I made some YouTube videos all about, biking on a recumbent bike, and I'm preserving my prostate is what I'm telling people. Because when you're on a road bike, even a mountain bike, but more on a road bike, you have that pointy little seat, and it goes up there and it hits that nerve right near your prostate, and it can cause prolonged inflammation of the prostate. So there is some potential evidence, let us put it that way, that people that bike long periods of time with those little race seats can aggravate their prostate and maybe even cause impotence. And nobody wants that. Heck, I have four kids, though, and I'm 55. I don't need any more kids. But sterility and impotence can occur from people doing road bike for long, long periods of time. So I think the recumbent bike, a lot more people are going to start riding these recumbent bikes, and even the trikes, the Cat trikes. They're carbon fiber now, so they're very light. Actually, I go about 1 mile an hour faster than I did on my triathlon bike. On the recumbent bike, because it's so low and aerodynamic and sleek.
Huh. Now, you just prompted me to bring up an episode I had, episode 11, which is Dr. Eric Goodman. He has a thing called foundation training, and some of his top clients are Lance Armstrong, I think at the US or British cycling team. And it's a lot of the same problem. They have back problems from being in that hunch position, and the whole posterior chain getting very weak. So that's something me passing to you. Foundation training, it was so good. I healed my back with it. I actually went out to California and got certified. So
fantastic.
Amazing, amazing thing, and especially for cyclists, because they get the short hamstrings and you right. know, that almost fetal position that they're in for so long.
And I think it's a good idea to mix it up a little bit, you know, and that's why I still ride my road bike. I do the mountain bike. I do the recumbent bike. I also have a trike. And so you can mix it up a little bit. And then I just got into a sport now, since we live on the bay, I'm doing a lot of sculling. So it's a row, and you go out and scull, and that's amazing, the amount of workout you get for your legs, cardio, upper body. I mean, I think for overall exercise, rowing in a scull is probably one of the best forms of exercise. But, you know, in order to slow down the aging in our body and thus our eyes, you have to be cardiovascularly fit. You got to exercise. I always tell my patients, my listeners on my talk show, I tell them, you know, 20 minutes minimum, 5 days a week of cardiovascular exercise, preferably more, but 20 minutes minimum, 30 minutes in the gym pumping iron, preferably more than that as well. But that's an absolute minimum. 30 minutes of weight-bearing exercise, 20 minutes of cardiovascular exercise. A lot of my patients will come into the office and say, well, I walk 5 miles a day. That sounds impressive, right? But then I tell them, get up, show me how you walk. And they just a little stroll. Their pulse isn't going, you know, over resting. So it's not doing much for cardiovascular. So I tell them the power walk, you know. They don't have to go 5 miles. They can power walk for a half a mile. But, you know, interval training is great. But we got to do cardio. We got to do weight-bearing exercise. That combined with the proper sleep, the proper diet, the right amount of sunshine. Sunshine is very important. We've been brainwashed, stay out of the sun because it causes skin cancer. There's actually studies that indicate people that are out of the sun are more prone to get skin cancer, horrendous skin cancers, than people that are in it a moderate amount. So you don't want to get sunburned, but you want to be out there in the sun. And the combination of all of that is anti-aging.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm known for just wearing shorts when I work out, and, you know, shoes hardly ever as well. But I noticed that myself. You know, I mean, I'm from England and I'm able to tolerate the sun here in Florida fine, as long as you're not out there for too long. And I the more I read, the more they seem to be linking a lot of the cancers to the sun blocks and sunscreens that they are on the actual sun itself.
I haven't used a sunscreen in probably 20 years, you know, maybe more than that, when my mom made me use a sunscreen. Because I think there's a lot of chemicals in those sunscreens, and who knows if those chemicals aren't some of the culprits for the basal cell and squamous cell carcinomas that we see. It's interesting. My dad has never used a sunscreen, grew up as a farm boy in South Dakota, never used sunscreen, never had any skin cancer. My mom, on the other hand, has used sunscreen all of her life, Montgomery, Alabama, so there's a different genetic there, but she's had some horrendous skin cancers. So there could be a point there. Remember, everything in moderation. You don't want to be out there and get totally burned. You just want to get, you know, a little bit of sun. And most studies indicate, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, depending on the size, your weight, and the color of your skin. So I'm blonde hair, green eyes, about, you know, 195 pounds. So 20 minutes to 30 minutes a day is plenty for me. And I've tested my 25-hydroxy. That's a blood test. And my blood levels of vitamin D range between 80 and 90. And that's where I tell people to try to get theirs, between 80 and 90. But if you're darkly pigmented and you're overweight, then you got to be out in the sun longer than that, probably 45 minutes to an hour, and you won't get burned. But that vitamin D deficiency is linked with macular degeneration, linked with dry eye, linked with diabetes, many forms of cancers, rheumatoid arthritis. Remember, vitamin D is a potent steroid hormone. So it's an anti, not only is it an antioxidant, but it's anti-inflammatory. So we got to get our vitamin D. Then people say, well, I take vitamin D. My doctor prescribed vitamin D. It's different. People don't have the digestive enzymes, the probiotics, the intrinsic factors in their stomach to actually absorb the vitamin D orally the way they do when they go out in the sun. And some people are taking way too much. If you take too much vitamin D3 orally, it can actually increase your risk of atrial fibrillation, a heart problem we don't want. But you won't get that from the sun itself. Now, another little tidbit of information that people don't realize, when you're out in the sun, don't go get in the soapy shower right afterwards, because the soaps are going to wash off the oils that are allowing the vitamin D to absorb. So most studies indicate 6 to 8 hours after being in the sun before you use any soap on your body. Now, let's say you're out for 30 minutes in between, you know, your lunch break, and you got to take a quick shower so you don't stink. Well, get in and wash under your arms, all right, with soap, but just use regular water on the rest of your body so the vitamin D will actually absorb.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, I know that the percentage you absorb through sunlight is just a huge amount more than you can orally as well. So, I mean, it's a no-brainer, and it's free.
Right,
so.
And vitamin A will block the absorption of vitamin D. And so vitamins that I've developed have no vitamin A and no beta carotene in it. Vitamin A actually blocks the absorption of D3. So if you have a multivitamin out there that has vitamin A in it, it's blocking the absorption of the vitamin D3. And if it has beta carotene in it, it's blocking the absorption of the xanthophylls, lutein, zeaxanthin, and astaxanthin that are incredible for the skin and the retina, thus your vision. So beta carotene and vitamin A, I don't like those in multivitamins. Copper and zinc, I don't like in multivitamins either.
Right. Okay, well, we're talking about vision, so let's kind of bring in the whole first responder thing. So I'm going to start with a very, very brief story of why I wasn't a fireman in England. So I grew up, had basically very poor vision in my right eye. And then when I did the color vision tests, the ink block test, whatever the official name is, I can see some of the numbers, not others. So in the British medical system, they said, James, you're colorblind. You can never be a fighter pilot, a fireman, or all in this other list of cool jobs. Here's the crap ones left for you to do. So I literally went years. I trained one of my friends to become a fireman on the fitness side. And it wasn't until I came to the US, and I don't even know what clicked in me, but one day I realized I can see these different colors. I can differentiate the traffic lights. And really, it was just a kind of leap of faith. I went through fire school everywhere. I did the medical, and they just showed me the little pegs they have outside the doctor's office, and they asked me just to read those colors. And I read them off perfectly, and they went, all right, they checked the box. So with color vision specifically, I realized, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it was like vision, that you weren't either completely gray blind or perfect color vision, that there was a spectrum in between. And I was not too far off normal. I just would never be a fashion designer, probably. So let's talk about color vision first. So, A, how valid is that color vision test today in 2017?
Well, it is a very valid test, but it's almost a useless test. And the reason for this is you have a color deficiency. Nobody's really truly colorblind. It is very rare. Colorblind means you only see in black and white. And that's a very, very rare. I've never seen it in my life. Color deficiency is very common, and you probably have a red-green deficiency. We have red-green deficiencies and blue-yellow deficiencies. And so that means, yes, a job like a fashion coordinator, all right, probably wouldn't be ideal because you have trouble differentiating between different hues of reds and different hues of green. But if I hold a cap that's red and one green, you can definitely say it's red and green. It will not affect your life in anything you do unless you're having to match colors that are very similar. So you could be a jet fire pilot. You could be a policeman. You could be a military. It's not going to affect you at all. But for some reason, if you want to go into the military, even the Coast Guard or anything like that, you know, you have to pass these color plates, Ishihara color plate test. And then we have Farnsworth lantern test, which is even more difficult. And it's interesting because a lot of people don't get the job they want because they're, quote, colorblind, and all there is have a very mild color deficiency that won't affect them. I've gotten many people able to fly helicopters and become jet fighter pilots, commercial airline pilots, by simply writing a letter The eye doctor writes a letter and they're able to get that job. If they require you to pass an Ishihara color plates, well, we do have contact lenses. Not many doctors know about this. They don't know how to fit them. They don't even know they exist. It's called X-Chrome. X-Chrome is a contact lens, soft lens you wear on your non-dominant eye, and you could pass every single plate on the color plate test. So that's something that's available, X-Chrome, for color vision anomalies. So anybody listening, if they want to go and pass those color plates, ask your local optometrist to fit you in. Well, call around first, because 90% of them have no clue what you're talking about, in an X-Chrome contact lens, and you'll pass.
That's fantastic, because like I said, that was the only stumbling block. I'm not saying that I was maybe physically ready. When I was 18, I was very small and everything, and you know, life unfolds the way it's supposed to. So I was obviously meant to become here and become a fireman and also be a medic at the same time. But that literally was the only stumbling block, and you know, was totally discounted the even possibility of doing it, because there was none of that conversation. So I'm hoping that someone out listening now, that might be the only thing that's in their way. And there you go, you have a solution. So with the vision itself, my left eye to this day is amazing. Did all the work for my right. My right was crap. I went and had LASIK done, which I mean, I could pass the test with the glasses on. But can you tell me something about LASIK? I have to say the LASIK to me worked phenomenally well. The recovery wasn't even close to as quick as they said it was going to be. I had dry eye and itchiness for months, but I've still got 20/15 on the test these days. So can you give us a little history about that? And then, you know, is the current one the best one, or is there even better stuff coming?
Absolutely. LASIK surgery's come a long way. I was actually with Dr. Stephen Brent at the Eye Surgery Center of Louisiana in New Orleans in 1991, when he did the first LASIK procedure in America. And then I opened three LASIK centers here in Florida. And LASIK is really in the hands of a competent LASIK surgeon with new generation technology. It's an amazing procedure, right? Remember what your mama said, you get what you pay for. If it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. Be very leery or weary of these bait and switch organizations that are claiming $199 per eye for LASIK surgery. Nobody's doing LASIK surgery for $199. You're going to go there and then you're going to say, oh, Mr. Smith, your parameters aren't correct. Now you got to go up to $1,500 per eye if you want to have LASIK surgery. So, you know, the going rate right now is about $1,500 an eye, about $3,000 to have LASIK. I always recommend asking how many procedures the LASIK surgeon has done. You want that LASIK surgeon to done over 10,000 procedures. Simple as that. I mean, many of my colleagues have done over 100,000 procedures now. So you want at least 10,000, because you don't want to be the first on the block or the first 10. You want to have somebody that's very seasoned, a veteran at this. You want to use new generation technology, not old technology from 20 years ago, 15 years ago. So ask how old is their laser. You want an all laser procedure where they create the flap with the laser, an all laser procedure. I like the Allegretto. It's one of the best lasers out there. But many of the companies make great lasers now. So remember, good technology and a great surgeon with a lot of experience. But also, you have to go 2 consecutive years with no change in your vision. So go see your local optometrist. If you're a -2 myope, that's a number, and then next year you're -250, you've progressively got a little worse, you should not have LASIK surgery. Go 2 years with no change, then you can have LASIK surgery. It's great for people that are athletes. It's great for firemen or police officers that are in a potential situation where if their glasses fog up or their contacts come out, life could be in jeopardy. You know, racing cars, racing motorcycles, things like that is great for those people. On the other side of the coin, there's an old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And if you can wear contact lenses successfully, or you like wearing glasses and you have no problems at all, why do surgery, all right? Because surgery is not without potential complications. Remember, we minimize the complications with good surgeons, a lot of experience, good technology, but even with the best and the most competent hands, the best technology, something can go wrong. You know, it's obviously not purposely, but something can go wrong. Everybody's eye reacts differently to surgery. So once again, if you have no problems, you know, why do surgery? But if you're a fireman, you know, law enforcement, military, you know, a big athlete, extremely nearsighted, where when you take your glasses off, you can't see at night. So you jump up, you don't know if it's your wife or a burglar in the house, then certainly these people are great candidates for LASIK surgery.
Yeah. See, the area where I found I had a problem was not so much in a fire, because you can't see anything anyway, pretty much, but it was driving to and from, especially at dusk. You know, you've got your sunglasses, and I think it's changed a little bit more now, but at the time, it seemed like you could just get the, you know, serial killer looking prescription sunglasses, and then you'd have to switch to the clear ones as it got towards night, and then having these two pairs, you know, it would always fall over and then land on the diamond plate and get scratched, or I'd lose them, or I'd step on them. So yeah, that for me was a huge thing. And then obviously then when I was on a scene, I could see a little bit more detail. I could see if someone was, you know, hanging out of a window, even if it was several stories up, right, versus that slight blurriness I had before. So for me, it worked very well. I only had one eye done. That's all I needed to have done. It was about exactly like you said, about $1,500. But I would say that investment was well worth it.
Right. Once again, it's your livelihood, the job that you're doing it. Perfect for you.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, so the next was kind of transitions quite well. I want to talk after this about some of the common problems that you see with vision, but the one thing that LASIK doesn't fix is the aging of the eye, isn't it? So can you tell us the difference between what LASIK does fix and then what happens as we age?
Right, so when we hit the age 40, that's called presbyopia. That's when the human crystalline lens in the eye loses its elasticity and we lose that ability to focus up close. LASIK will not fix that. So if you have LASIK at 21 years of age, you're going to have great vision. When you hit 40, 45 years of age, your arms aren't long enough anymore. You find you're holding things out further and further to see clearly, and that's when you have to wear reading glasses or bifocals or progressive lenses or a multifocal contact lens. However, there is some evidence now, and I've been leading this this whole field, this arena in research, there is some evidence if we consume certain foods, more of certain foods, we can actually improve the focusing ability in our eye. And the big food, one food that's a power food, is wild Alaskan salmon.
Oh, really?
So wild Alaskan salmon, not only very high in omega-3, but high in a supercarotenoid called astaxanthin. This is what gives the wild Alaskan salmon its orange color. It's the algae, something called hematococcus, that the little fish eat, and then the salmon eat the little fish, and they get this astaxanthin into their body. It improves muscle endurance and muscle recovery in the body. It improves night vision, reaction time, great for a firefighter, all right? It also helps impregnate into the macula zone, helping to filter out some of the harmful blue light that can be very damaging. It actually impregnates into the skin, so you don't have to use a sunscreen. But it will not block the vitamin D3 absorption. So wild Alaskan salmon, if you eat that frequently, then your focusing ability will be better. Now, you have to eat it almost every day. Now, most people aren't going to do that. And it's got to be wild salmon, not farm-raised salmon. So I actually developed a supplement called Fortify Focus. And this is about 8 years ago now. I've gone into the fourth revision of it, and we've taken carotenoids, lutein, zeaxanthin isomers, and 6 milligrams of astaxanthin that was in all the studies. And I'm 55 years of age. I've been on it 6 years now. When I was 49, I had to wear reading glasses for anything up close. Now at 55, if I'm going to sit down and read a small print book, I will put reading glasses on if I'm going to sit down and read it late at night for a long period of time. But for my job purposes, I can read anything I need, my cell phone. I can see anything I need up close ever since I've been taking this one little pill, Fortify Focus, once a day. So remember, aging is oxidation and inflammation. And so astaxanthin is the most potent natural anti-inflammatory known to man. And then the lutein and zeaxanthin in it add more oxidative stress, combating against free radicals. So lutein, zeaxanthin, and astaxanthin, those three combined help to combat against free radical damage, which is oxidation or the rusting of our body. So I call it a little anti-aging pill, combating against oxidation and inflammation in the entire body, but targeting the eye. It actually crosses the blood retinal barrier, getting into the eye. And now you got to think about this. Everybody is on a digital apparatus these days. We're all on an iPhone, an iPad, a laptop, a computer. We're watching TV on LED screens. We have LED lighting now. So all of this emits blue light. And I've done a lot of research in this area. Blue light is very damaging to your eye. We're seeing children now at very young ages developing a form of degeneration in their macula that they shouldn't be getting until they're 75 years of age. And we're just about 100% know now it's related to all this blue light exposure. And so you can wear lenses now that actually guard against blue light. Blue light defense is a great lens. And you can take a little pill that has the carotenoids. Remember, lutein and zeaxanthin isomers and astaxanthin act like an internal blue light filter. And so my 11-year-old daughter, Mackenzie, I make her, when she's doing her work at night, wear blue light defense lenses and take one little pill a day of the Fortify Focus. I take it. My 89-year-old parents take it. I think I've had 250,000 people throughout the world that are taking it now. So remember, if you eat the foods, you don't need to take the supplement. But realistically, are we all eating wild Alaskan salmon, organic kale, organic orange bell peppers, and goji berries on a daily basis?
Probably not. Okay, well, a couple of things I want to touch on from what you were talking about. The very first thing was you were talking about elasticity. A few years ago, it seemed like one of the optical buzzes were exercises that you could do for your eyes. Was there any validity in that?
The see clearly method.
Yes.
Yeah, it was like 89, 99 or something like that, three easy payments. You know, that one, there was a class action suit against them and they had to give all their money back, is last I heard. They did a lot of marketing, a lot of advertising for this. I had people that brought this into my office, the whole packet, the book, everything, and say it didn't work, it didn't work, it didn't work. And they were actually targeting talk shows, all right? There was on talk radio where people that are, you know, between 25 and 55, 65 listen. The people they were going after were the LASIK markets. And it does not work for that. You can do eye exercises all day long. I don't care. If you're a minus four myope, that means you cannot see in the distance at all. You got to put your glasses on or your contacts in. You can do these exercises all day long. It's not going to change that. Now, that see clearly method did have some validity to it. I mean, a behavioral optometrist, a vision therapist can use that. I mean, that is tried and true for helping children in the developmental stages, children that have a lazy eye, an eye that turns in or out, children that have accommodative and focusing problems, they overfocus, they underfocus. Absolutely. That system is probably really great for that. But to target people that are wanting LASIK surgery, it wasn't a good thing.
Right. Okay. So there's some validity, but it's more of a narrower field than they let us believe.
Right. I think at the age from birth to about probably 14 or 15 years of age, certainly the right forms of eye exercises can help the eye. And even as you get older, I mean, it can help improve circulation to the muscles in the eye. So I even tell my elderly patients just to gaze left and right on the wall, up and down, you know, just to get some extreme gazes in. You know, it can help probably strengthen the muscles a little, but it helps improve circulation.
Right. So, or just go outside and be in nature where you'll naturally look around anyway instead of at a screen like we all do these days. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, one of the big things that I harp on in these podcasts is the ill effects of many of our jobs on us. And some are out of our control. Some I think we can take more of a control. But one area is sleep deprivation. Is there a specific effect on the optical side as far as sleep deprivation is concerned?
Well, sleep deprivation is huge in this country. I was probably the biggest sleep-deprived person you've ever met, you know, and has developing six companies over the last 25 years. And I sleep like a baby now. And one of the reasons for sleep deprivation in today's society is the blue light, right? It's everywhere. So what happens is that blue light goes into the eye. It tells the pineal gland in the brain, do not secrete melatonin. Melatonin levels do not go up. Then you go to bed at night. You don't sleep. You turn and flip over, and you don't get a good night's sleep. You're not dreaming. When you dream, that means you're going through REM phase of sleep, and that means you're sleeping. You're sleeping in the right phase of sleep that is restful, that lowers cortisol levels, which is a stress hormone in your body, that if you're sleep deprived, cortisol levels go way up. Inflammation goes way up. People get anxiety disorders, panic attacks, arthritis, all sorts of problems just from being sleep deprived. Remember when we're talking about anti-aging, one of the biggest things is getting a good night's sleep. So as a rule of thumb, I mean, one time I actually took the kids up to the mountains up in Tennessee, and we got there, and it's up on the top of this big hill. We were going mountain biking and kayak and whitewater rafting, and the actual cabin had no electricity. It had electricity, but the guy had not paid the bill.
Oh.
And so our cell phones didn't work up there either. I got to tell you, we did not. It was around Halloween, so it was kind of cool. It wasn't hot, so it wasn't that bad. We actually did. We were there for 5 days. We read everything by candlelight. At night when it got dark, we actually went to bed. It's the best sleep I've gotten probably in my entire life. We felt so rejuvenated after that 5-6 days because we were sleeping. I mean, it gets 8 o'clock at night. We got into bed and we went to bed. And it's because our melatonin levels were going up. We didn't have all this artificial lighting that's simulating the sun, telling the brain don't secrete melatonin. So as a rule of thumb, to sleep better at night, you make your room as dark as you can. You don't want any LED lights from anything. LED lights, take some electrical tape, put it over the smoke detector, the carbon dioxide detector on your TV, unplug the clock radio, unplug anything within 15 feet of your bed. You don't want any electrical current within 15 feet of your bed. Put your cell phone in the bathroom. Put it on high so you can hear if it's an emergency if you're on call, but don't put it by your bed. So everything away from you, make your room as dark as you can, and turn the air conditioning down as low as you can tolerate it. Dark and cool, and you'll sleep a lot better. As a rule of thumb, you don't want any visual stimuli 3 hours before bed. Now, that's hard because people want to watch TV. They want to watch the news. But if you really want to sleep well and practice anti-aging, no computer work, iPhone, iPad, television for 3 hours before bed.
Well, we've had two episodes now on sleep. One was Kurt Parsley, who was a Navy SEAL turned MD. And then just about two episodes ago, I had Nick Littlehales, who is sleep coach to some of the top sports teams in the world. And he was saying that recently he's done exactly that for his own home, where he's just trying an experiment where he does candlelight as soon as it gets dark. And I think he reported pretty much the same thing. So it's amazing when I start having these podcasts overlap with each other, and blue light is you know, a massive one. And he was explaining that the light from a fire, light from a candle, light from the stars, because it doesn't have the blue light, you don't get that stimulus of it's daytime now. And they had the technology of when you do work some wonky hours, you need to kind of break that cycle and simulate the daylight, then you deliberately put the blue light into your life. But
right. And you can go to a website I created called bluelightdefense.com. And people can go to that, bluelightdefense.com, and you can see links to some studies from Harvard, some really legitimate studies. You can see some of the stuff that I've written on there about, you know, blocking and filtering the blue light. I mean, it's a problem, and the optometry and ophthalmology is seeing that now we're trying to address what can we do. So right now, the best is to take the supplement that I talk about, the Fortify Focus, to block it with the correct type of lenses. A lot of lens companies are now coming out with lenses similar to blue light defense lenses that are filtering the blue light. Thing about blue light defense, it blocks 99.9% of the most detrimental to your retina blue light, which is 411 nanometers. Blocks 99% of that. Right now, most companies are blocking 20 to 30%. So that's why I like the blue light defense. There's a few other lenses on the market that do that, but they're few and far between. But I predict in the next year, and I know this for a fact, that some of the big lens manufacturers are going to the same monomer that's used in the blue light defense lens. So it's going to become mainstream in just about all glasses soon.
Right. Yeah. I know my wife just got it, and she hates going in any stores that have the, you know, the artificial light. It gives her headaches and all that kind of thing. And why wouldn't it? I mean, it's not light. It's not something that we're used to looking at. Okay. So specifically then, we talked about sleep deprivation and the inflammation. Are there any other eye problems that you tend to see a lot in police officers or firefighters or paramedics or military even?
Well, you know, I see a lot of cataracts, okay? And that's because a lot of these people are around toxic chemicals. They're around a lot of heat, trauma, all right? You can get trauma as a fireman or a policeman. So, and then a lot of times, their primary care physician is putting them on steroids for the inflammation they have in their body, all right? Things like prednisone and deltazone. and that creates cataracts as well, a type of cataract called posterior subcapsular cataract. The good news is cataract surgery is relatively simple. It's a 10-minute procedure. It's painless, no needles anymore. It's almost an all-laser procedure and a little ultrasound. But I do see a lot of cataracts. I see a lot of dry eye in this area. So using some good lubricating eye drops periodically. Believe it or not, taking a good omega-3 fish oil is a good idea. Omega-3 has been shown to help quell the dry eye, help reduce dry eye symptomology. Hydration is very important. Most of us do not drink enough water. If we're drinking water, we're drinking this purified water, not to mention any names for legal ramifications, but there's a lot of bottled water. Quite frankly, the majority of bottled water people drink, it's purified. So it's either reverse osmosis or distilled. You want to buy something, a bottled water, that says spring water because it's alkaline and has minerals in it, so the minerals don't leach out of your body when you're drinking something due to the laws of osmosis. So hydration is important, using artificial tears, taking omega-3. That'll help the dry eye. Dry eyes, sandy, gritty, burny, teary, itchy eyes. And you know, you guys are on call all the time, and it might be a long day, and then you have to wake up in the middle of the night to go to a fire. Well, your eyes could be dehydrated. They dehydrate when you sleep at night. By the end of the day, they're starting to dehydrate. And if you're having to drive relatively fast through a dark, you know, dark area, your vision has to be good. That's why you had LASIK surgery. Well, if your eyes are dry, the optics of the eye can drop as much as 75% at night. So that's why it's a good idea to have some artificial tears handy at the firehouse. And right before you get out in that rig to go drive to the fire, you know, put some lubricating eye drops in the eye, especially if it's in the evening, because it's going to improve optics dramatically. Race car drivers that do it, if you're 12 hours of Le Mans, 24 hours of Daytona, you know, race car drivers will put artificial tears in their eyes because the optics of their eyes are going to work a lot better while they're driving.
Okay. Now, I know it's very simplified, but is the eye repairing itself when it's closed during sleep?
Absolutely. The cornea is one part of your body that regenerates. And so when you sleep, let's say you scratch your eye, all right, you get a corneal abrasion. It's a lot of pain because the cornea has more nerve endings than any part of your body. But close your eyes. When you go to bed at night, that epithelium starts to heal and grow back. And so I can see people with horrendous corneal abrasions or pieces of steel in the eye, and we have to remove the rust. So we have to use a drill in the cornea to remove the rust. And, you know, we've iatrogenically created a massive abrasion on their cornea. They're in severe pain. Well, 24 hours, it's healed 80%. 48 hours, it's usually healed almost 100%. So the cornea does heal very rapidly in most healthy, non-immune compromised people. But as you get older, all right, and you become immune compromised with different diseases, then the cornea doesn't heal. And that's one of the biggest avenues that I see, that patients come in with severe dry eyes. But the Lang Eye Institute, my average age patient is 75. So I see patients over 100. And so these people, just simply using artificial tears isn't enough for them.
Right. Yeah. Because that's another thing about every third day us being awake. I mean, some departments are awake pretty much all night. You know, that's one day in three that they're not able to repair their eyes. So I'm sure that has a long-term effect too.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So I was just going to transition to something. I've forgotten what it was now. Oh, that's right. So you were talking about foreign objects in the eyes. So that's a real bone of contention for us on the EMS side. We'll get called for a 911 call, and it will be, you know, foreign body, corneal scratch. These patients are expected to be taken to the ER. Let me put it very bluntly. Who is the best kind of professional to treat that kind of injury? Not like a knife sticking out of the eye, but something a little more
absolutely
minor.
Absolutely. I mean, the emergency room isn't the best place to go because they're not prepared for that. You know, go to your local optometrist or local ophthalmologist, because they have the slit lamp, the biomicroscope, they have the technology, they have the training. We have certain types of Alger brushes, spuds, things that we can get foreign bodies, microscopic. I mean, we can magnify things 1,000 times or more if we have to. And so we can get the smallest little particulate matter out. A lot of times you'll go to the emergency room, not to put down the emergency room, great place, but you know, you have a red irritated eye and they think you have pink eye. They put you on an antibiotic drop, okay, when it wasn't pink eye. It was something that was in the eye that they didn't know you had that was creating this problem. or it was a virus, and an antibiotic does absolutely nothing. So the gist of this story, if you learn anything from this podcast, if you have a red irritated eye, go to the eye doctor, whether it's the optometrist or the ophthalmologist, it doesn't matter. Both of them are capable and trained to treat it medically and even surgically if necessary.
Okay. So then this is kind of a general question, but at what point would you go to the ER? Are there any specific anatomical signs for the eye where you're like, okay, this is out of our non-emergent state?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the emergency room, right? So here, luckily enough, we have, you know, University of Florida Shands, University of South Florida Tampa General. So these emergency rooms do have ophthalmologists that are on call, residents that are on call. So if you have a sudden loss of vision, you know, a whole curtain comes over your vision and it's, you know, it's midnight, you can't go to your local eye doc. Well, you could go to an emergency room that has ophthalmology on call. If they don't, if it's a hospital and it doesn't, then just waste your time. You can't go. They can't do anything. And you're going to sit in the emergency room for 7 hours and they're going to charge you $1,500 and they weren't able to do anything. So usually a university-based emergency room, you know, if it's a, you know, 30 minutes more to drive, that's where you need to go if you're having some kind of significant eye problem. Now, obviously, if you get an acid in your eye or something like that, you can go to the local emergency room. But the key for something like that, a chemical gets in your eye of some sort, whether it's a base or an acid, you got to irrigate your eye out. And the faster you irrigate out, the better. So here's an example. Let's say you're drinking a Coca-Cola, believe it or not, and somehow acid just gets in your eye immediately. Don't go upstairs and go in the shower. Throw that Coca-Cola in your eye, believe it or not. If you can drink it, you can put it in your eye immediately. The faster you neutralize the chemical in your eye, the better. And then get to the sink and lavage your eye for, you know, 10, 15 minutes. Then you can go to the emergency room because they can help with the pain and they can help with it. So that's an emergency. A true ocular emergency is any type of chemical, acid, or base in your eye. That's an emergency. Has to be treated immediately. A central retinal artery occlusion is an emergency, but most emergency rooms aren't going to handle that. That's when an artery gets occluded. They have to give you a clot buster, and usually it's a retina specialist that would do this, or they got to do central paracentesis where they puncture the eye, lower the pressure immediately. And so very rarely would the emergency room even know what's going on there. An acute angle glaucoma attack is also something. That's when you get severe pain in the eye, blurred vision, and you're actually throwing up. You throw up severe pain and blurred vision. That's usually an acute angle glaucoma attack. The pressure's gone up to 70, 80, or even 90 in your eye. And I guess you definitely could go to the emergency room for that. They probably won't know what to do, but they could call a doctor on call, and they could start an IV. They could give you a Diamox. They could put some drops in their eyes. And many emergency rooms should be aware of what that is also. Now emergency rooms are starting to check the pressure in the eye, and that is a true emergency. So that's another one you could go to the emergency room for as well.
Okay, because two things. Firstly, what you just described from the paramedic's point of view, we would think that was probably a bleed, cerebral bleed with the blur vision, the vomiting.
Right.
But it would be obviously intracranial pressure that was going up. And then what you said about the ophthalmologist being on call, the two hospitals that you named were what we call in our field level one trauma centers. So that's kind of a good correlation as well. If we do have something where there is more trauma to the eye, that knowing that those kind of doctors are on staff there too, I think is very helpful for me as a medic to
right.
to know that's part of the chain of care. All right, so one last one with optometry before we transition into the supplement size. What are some of the biggest myths in optometry? Or, you know, known by the general public.
Right. Well, you know, they're thinking, oh, an optometrist isn't an eye doctor, okay? An optometrist isn't trained, you know. If you're not an ophthalmologist, you know, you're not a doctor, which that's crazy because you have to go to 4 years of college and then 4 years of optometry school at a minimum. And now many optometrists are doing a 1 year in a residency or 2 year residency and another year to two in fellowship. And they're trained every bit as good as an ophthalmologist in disease management, in treatment of diseases like glaucoma, conjunctivitis, you know, lacerated corneas, and now surgical intervention as well. So depending on the state, many optometrists are doing laser procedures, photorefractive keratectomy, which is a form of LASIK surgery, you know, glaucoma laser procedures and things like this. So it's changed dramatically. I mean, I think 80 years ago, optometry was a 2-year program, but now an optometrist is, like I said, your primary eye care physician that would do everything except major internal surgery. Then they'll refer you to the ophthalmologist that's fellowship trained in that particular area. So it's just like if you got a little ache in your knee, you don't go straight to the orthopedic surgeon and have knee surgery, all right? You go to your primary care physician. You got a little arthritis, you go to the rheumatologist, but you don't go straight to the orthopedic surgeon. You can think of it like that. The optometrist is kind of like the primary care physician of the eye, and the ophthalmologist is kind of like the orthopedic surgeon. It's the surgeon of the eye.
Okay. Now, one more optical question I just realized I missed. You are developing a form of eye protection for extreme sports, and I'm assuming it would probably be very pertinent to tactical athletes as well. Could you tell us about that?
Right. I've been working on it for many years, and I've got some really cool prototypes. I'm testing one right now, driving at 200 miles an hour, and I've done things like we've gone kayaking with them and flipped over in rafts and mountain biking and you know, put all the elements on the lenses to see how they react. So what I wanted to do is develop a lens that is almost impervious to scratching, that's impact resistant to a .22 caliber bullet, that increases your contrast. So depending on the particular sport, it can benefit you, whether you're golf or baseball or, you know, driving a race car, whatever you're doing, it's going to increase visual performance. A lot of sunglasses have terrible optics. A lot of the lenses are made in China, and the optics are terrible. You put them on, and you actually see worse than when they're on off. And so polarization isn't always ideal. Polarized lenses are great for if you're on the water. If you're a fisherman and you're on the water at the pool, it blocks the glare. But polarization blocks one whole meridian of a light. And so if you're mountain biking, you're going down a jagged downhill under the canopy of oak trees, it can be very dangerous wearing polarized lenses because you can't see the detail of that jagged, and you're going to, you know, hit one of the rocks and you're going to endo and potentially break your neck. Also, if you're riding a motorcycle, a street bike, we call them crotch rockets, or even just a cruiser, you never want polarized lenses because when you're coming into a turn relatively fast, and it has an oil slick in that turn or a water slick, you don't see it because you don't see the glare because the polarization blocks the glare. So the only time I recommend polarized lenses are for people that fish or on the water, or, you know, if you just want driving glasses and you're not an aggressive driver, then absolutely polarized is good. So I'm trying to develop lenses that have extreme optics. They're non-polarized with different tints, totally impact resistant, but that are very comfortable, and we're trying to work an ergonomic design that if you're playing a sport where you bend over or you look to different extreme angles, you're not going to see the frame. It's not going to interfere with your vision. So we try to take all that into consideration, and I'm still in the process of working on it in my free time.
Okay, because, yeah, I mean, the way you describe it, that would definitely be something that we want, because I know just the scratch. I know my wife's not going to listen to this, so I'm going to say it. She bought me some Oakleys with her discount voucher she gets at her place. Right. And I took my shirt off. The damn things fell off my head, and then tiny little scratch already in them. So the scratch resistance in our profession is huge, because, you know, we're not walking around just getting them to put them neatly back in a case and, you know, clean the lenses. Sometimes we get a few seconds to put them down when we're getting toned out for a fire or something like that. So
yeah, there is technology out there that can make the lenses almost impervious to be scratching in a plastic type of monomer, not a glass lens.
Okay.
It's just that it's relatively expensive, and I want to make these sunglasses cost affordable. I don't want them to be $300, and I want them to be at an affordable price for most people.
Brilliant. Okay, so the other area that you are very entrenched in is nutrition. So I'm going to start with a very blanket statement, and then we can kind of hone in and talk about some of the things that we were talking about before we started recording. What are some of the biggest nutritional errors that we're making as a nation that are causing so much disease that we're seeing at the moment?
It's our diet. It's the typical American diet is pro-inflammatory, all right? It's very high in omega-6, very high in sugar, carbohydrates, and it's pro-inflammatory. And so that's why our country, everybody's obese. They're overweight and have inflammation that's, you know, on fire in their body. And remember, aging, oxidation, and inflammation. So the number one thing, and I preach this to my patients, to my radio listeners when I lecture, is you got to adjust your diet. I like the paleo diet the best. You know, the paleo diet, you don't have to be on a low-carb diet. You don't have to be on the Atkins diet. I mean, some of these diets are very bad for you because there's no nourishment. There's no vitamins. A lot of people lose weight very quickly on them, but they become immune compromised because there's no nutritional value. There's no vitamins and minerals, but they do lose weight, and that's important. But you can lose weight and be healthy at the same time. Actually, I created a diet. You can Google it, the Lang diet, Lang diet plan, and it's a modified version of the paleo diet. And the paleo diet uses what God put on this planet. No processed, no overly processed foods. There's no pasta. There's no bread. Really, there's no rice. Nothing that doesn't grow from the tree or that's natural. You can eat beef. You can eat chicken. You can eat turkey. You got to prepare it. Fish. You can eat fruits and vegetables. Milk is not really in the paleo diet, but that's where I disagree with it. We use goat milk and A2 cow's milk in the Lang diet because I think it's actually very good for you. So we got to get rid of the typical pro-inflammatory diet. I mean, you ask people, what do they have for breakfast? And most of my patients had a piece of toast, had a bagel and a cup of coffee. I had some cereal and orange juice, sugar and more sugar, all right? You know, I had a donut, you know? I had a Pop-Tart. You know, nobody's eating. The most important time to eat protein is breakfast and supper, right? And it should be protein and vegetables. So an egg omelet, free-range organic eggs, and saute it in coconut oil, and put some kale and spinach and maybe mushrooms and bell peppers, saute it in there, and a big glass of spring water or green tea. That should be your breakfast. Or you can make a smoothie with a good whey protein we'll talk about in a minute. But stay away from those carbs. Remember, your blood sugar is as high as it gets first thing in the morning. And then you're putting sugar on top of it. And you wonder why your kids aren't making good grades. You're giving them the colorful, sugary cereal that they love, a glass of chocolate milk, and then they can't pay attention in class because their pancreas over-secretes insulin, and then they drop. They start to go down, and their mind can't think. They can't concentrate. So they get labeled as attention deficit disorder, learning disabled, hyperactive. And it's the breakfast. Breakfast is the most important meal. So start using protein and vegetables. I don't even like fruit for breakfast. Fruit is for snacks or for lunch. No fruit for supper. Supper should be like boiled chicken and some boiled broccoli or some tuna fish and a tuna salad or something. You know, a salad and a lean piece of grass-fed organic beef. And some vegetables. Fruit is for lunchtime or for snacks. You know, you can have a little slice of pineapple and a handful of nuts as a snack in between meals. We should eat 5 meals a day, 3 regular meals and then 2 small meals or 2 snacks in between. That keeps our metabolism going, keeps our blood sugar from yo-yoing up and down, up and down. But yeah, the diet is the number one thing we need to adjust, and we need to go to a anti-inflammatory diet. And it's hard for people to do because a lot of people aren't liking fish and they're not eating the fish that helps give them the omega-3 that they so urgently need. So taking a good omega-3 fish oil is a good way of, even if you're eating that Burger King Whopper every now and then, I mean, remember, everything in moderation, taking a good omega-3 fish oil, between 1,500 and 2,000 milligrams of a fish oil in the triglyceride form, I created one called Fortify Super Omega, will help lower the inflammation in your body related to that nasty diet. So that's a good way, because a lot of people aren't going to change their diet that much, but they could certainly take 2 fish oils a day. Now, when we talk about omega-3, over-the-counter omega-3, people can test their omega-3 and find out if it's good or not. Simply bite your omega-3 in 2, squeeze it in a styrofoam cup and see what happens. If within 10 minutes it rots a hole through that cup, you got to think twice about putting it in your system. 95% of all fish oil you buy over the counter is an ethyl ester molecule. That means it has ethanol attached to the backbone. They use that in the distillation and purification process. They don't take it out because it's expensive to remove. We do a process like that, but then we remove the ethanol and replace a triglyceride backbone the way fish naturally have it in the sea. Makes it absorb much quicker. It doesn't go rancid. You don't get the fishy burp back either. but it lowers inflammatory markers in your body. So C-reactive protein, tumor necrosis factor, arachidonic acid, things like this go down if you're taking the proper omega-3 fish oil. So I always preach that to patients. If you're going to take anything, if you only took one pill, not a multivitamin, it'd be a good omega-3 fish oil. Not krill oil. I think krill is a nutritional scam personally because there's no omega-3 in krill. The small little pills they're giving you in these omega reds has less than 100 milligrams of omega-3. So you'd have to take a whole bottle to get enough. So take a good triglyceride form omega-3 fish oil, and you'll find that next time you go to get your blood chemistries done at your primary care physician, they're starting to normalize.
Okay. Yeah, I think one of the best catchphrases, I guess you could say, is, I think it just hits it right on the head about where we're at the moment, is that we're overfed and malnourished. And those two, you know, don't make sense initially, but as you were saying, if you're not having that spectrum of color on your plate, you can be completely stuffed and have put nothing but bad stuff in your body versus, as you're saying, smoothies and salads and vegetables that will still be delicious and fill you up, but now you're nourishing instead of harming your
absolutely
body.
Absolutely. Colorful, especially vegetables. So you get kale and spinach, and orange, red, and yellow bell peppers, put some onions and some broccoli and some radishes, and you know, put a little salad dressing on it, or gently steam it, gently saute it, and a wild piece of Alaskan salmon or some chicken or some beef or pork or whatever. That's a meal. You know, you don't have to have, and you know, I love spaghetti and meatballs, let me tell you. And every now and then you got to have some lasagna, some spaghetti. But for the most part, you don't, because most of these are filled with gluten. And a lot of people have gluten sensitivities. They have celiac disease. But the thing I don't like is most of this is genetically modified. So there's a lot of pesticide. And that's why we see so many people with irritable bowel syndrome and acid reflux. It's from the foods they're eating, all the gluten. The FODMAP vegetables, these are fruits and vegetables that cause fermentation in your gut. A lot of people have reactions to these type of fruits and vegetables. Not everybody. So I can actually listen to my patients, and I'm their eye doctor, but I'm also their nutritional guru, and I can find out based on their history and their diet, you know, what's causing their bloating and what's causing their lack of energy. And we can simply totally adjust their diet, take the foods out without even doing any blood tests and anything to look for sensitivities, just based on the case history and looking at their stomach, if it's bloated and tender, we can adjust their diet and their lifestyle a little bit and help them dramatically. But they go to their primary care physician oftentimes and they prescribe an antacid. And that's just masking the problems and actually it's creating problems down the road because these antacids actually block the absorption of many nutrients, causing a malnourished environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, don't a lot of these antacids actually cause more pyruvic acid as well?
Is that the right? They secrete word? Because it's an antacid, so your body overcomes by secreting more acid. And so it can actually, in the short term, it can be beneficial, but if you use them chronically long term, it can be a horrendous problem for people.
Right. Brilliant. All right. So we were talking about dairy, and I told you that, you know, my story, and I think anyone that's listened to all the podcasts probably heard this. I had IBS. I had stomach issues my whole life. Grew up on a farm. Drank milk by the pint like it was water. And then 4 years ago, stopped dairy and almost overnight realized that was the underlying cause of a lot of my stomach issues. But we talked about A2 milk. And I literally, I think it was either today or yesterday, saw a commercial for the first time. Never even heard of it. So could you tell us what A2 milk is and why you do use that in the goat's milk?
Right. I started, you know, promoting A2 milk about 2.5-3 years ago now. And now it's becoming very vogue. And maybe it's due to my radio program. But so thousands of years ago, the typical cow went through a genetic mutation. And the beta casein protein actually went through this mutation. And it's an A1 beta casein protein is linked to irritable bowel, leaky gut, cancer, diabetes, and autism in children. And think we all know people that have all these things, and they've been drinking milk all their life. So goat milk has never gone through that genetic mutation. It has an beta casein, A2 beta casein protein. It does not cause any of those things, all right? People don't like the wild taste of goat milk for some reason. You acquire the taste, all right? But now the A2 cow company from New Zealand is now in the United States. And they actually genetically test every cow to make sure that they haven't gone through the genetic mutation producing A1 beta casein. And so I have many patients, many colleagues, many friends that were in the same situation with you. And they thought they were lactose intolerant. That was the problem. And they can drink A2 cow's milk and have no problem at all. So you're getting the benefits. And I like the whole milk because that fat in that milk is actually good for you. This is a grass-fed A2 cow. So try drinking A2 cows. Promised Land is another one you can buy that's from A2 cows, or goat's milk. And it's great because milk has eight grams of protein in one cup. So if you're making a protein drink, a lot of people are using almond milk or coconut milk or soy milk. God forbid, stay away from soy. All right, it screws up your hormones. But there's no protein, once again, but milk does have protein. Two cups of milk is going to have 16 grams of protein. So that and some eggs in the morning for breakfast and with some vegetables, and you're in good shape.
And then, so adding to that, you were telling me about your recovery shake that you developed or come across.
Well, interesting. You know, during some blood studies that I've done thousands of blood analysis on my patients with macular degeneration over the last 15 years. And one of the biggest nutritional deficiencies macular degeneration patients have, and then people over 50 in general, is glutathione. And so I tried using L-glutathione, N-acetylcysteine, different things to stimulate glutathione. Nothing really worked. But whey protein does. Whey protein concentrate much better than an isolate because it has the good fats, which has the immunoglobulins in it. And so I actually was using some whey proteins that you can only get prescription-wise. They were very expensive because the whey proteins you buy over the counter are kind of like the fish oil you buy over the counter. Most of them are coming from China, not to knock China, but I wouldn't consume anything in my body that came from China right now. And most of them, the protein has been bleached. Most have been filled with growth hormones to produce more milk, antibiotics, steroids, and then the grass, if they are dewy grass, has pesticide on it. But then most of them are fed grains. And so the grains are genetically modified grains, skewing the whole omega-3 profile in the milk. So I started researching because I wanted the best of the best for myself, my family, and my patients, and came to the conclusion New Zealand's the best place to get these cows. So we went and started a company, years ago, Fortify Vitamins, but we used this to be able to buy bulk direct from New Zealand. And we're using A2 cows, and it's not necessary for whey protein, but we're using, because the whey protein removes all the casein protein, but we're still using that herd. And we're using a concentrate, non-bleached whey protein concentrate. This is non-denatured because New Zealand does not heat the protein to denature it the way America does over 300 degrees. So the protein molecule is much more bioavailable. All the immune globulins remain intact. Something called covalent bonded cysteine is in it that converts to glutathione. Remember, glutathione is this big deficiency in most people over 50 and most patients with macular degeneration. So I developed Fortify Super Protein. We have it vanilla, chocolate, and now one called Naked, Fortify Naked Super Protein. And I think it's the ultimate protein in the United States right now. And so what happens is I also develop for my patients so they're not having the bagel and orange juice for breakfast. They're having a protein smoothie. They take a scoop of this. They can take some white A2 milk or goat's milk, put a little kale, maybe a banana and some blueberries, peanut butter or almond butter, blend it all together, and they got a protein-packed smoothie with antioxidants, anti-inflammatory for breakfast. Keeps them going until lunch. So post-recovery is something that's really great, and I did a lot of research on this. You can type in Google, the ultimate post-recovery workout drink. I come up number one in the world. And so after a lot of research, it's very simple. It's chocolate milk, watermelon, and Fortify Super Protein, one scoop. So one scoop of Fortify Super Protein has 21 grams of the fastest acting whey protein, two cups of chocolate milk, not the organic chocolate milk, A2 chocolate milk, or Promised Land chocolate milk, or goat's milk if they make a chocolate milk. And that's giving you another 16 grams on top of the 21 grams of protein. and then a big giant wedge of watermelon, and you blend it together. You drink it 1 minute to 30 minutes after working out, whatever your workout is, bike ride, a triathlon, swimming, hitting the weight, the gym, you know, the weights, you know, boxing, whatever it is, rowing. And it's the best post-recovery workout drink because right after working out, you want to have high glycemic index. Chocolate is high glycemic index. Watermelon is the highest glycemic index fruit known to man. So you have that. Watermelon is high in L-citrulline that converts to L-arginine, vasodilating the blood vessels, bringing the combination of whey protein and long-acting casein protein from the good milk to your muscles. It's an amazing post-recovery workout drink. It works. I've got literally thousands of patients taking it now. Bodybuilders, you know, power lifters, professional athletes, all doing amazingly well.
Okay. Well, I might have to try that because I'm working towards kind of like the hell week of the fire service that we get to volunteer for and pay for in the fire school here. So I'm doing a lot of training and gear and all that kind of thing. So it'd be a good time to try that and see if I can tolerate the A2 as well. So I think I'll give that a shot.
Post-workout.
Yes.
Pre-workout, you don't use chocolate milk. Pre-workout, and you don't use watermelon. You lose low glycemic index. So blueberries, strawberries, a scoop of the protein, white A2 cow's milk or goat's milk. And you can put a little Manuka honey. Manuka honey is also gives you some prolonged energy. Very good for digestion as well.
Okay, fantastic. Now, I'm going to wrap up in just a moment. But I want to touch on one thing that we just glossed over. So from my understanding, soy in the Japanese original form, where it's I'm forgetting the word now, but fermented, is a very good source of protein and in the healthy version. But what is it that we do here that makes soy bad, and what is it doing to the human body?
Yeah, the only soy that's any good is organic fermented soy, and then again in moderation. I wouldn't do it every day. The fermentation process, you know, really releases probiotics and some enzymes that are incredible for the digestive system. So I have a little miso soup and a little tempeh, and that's in the Lang diet. That's once or twice a week on the Lang diet plan. The problem with the soy here, 99.9% of it is all genetically modified. And, you know, that's a whole nother talk show. And I personally would stay away from GMOs, no matter what anybody tells you, right? And there's a lot of evidence why. So genetically modified products, you just don't want to ingest. But soy, even edamame, you know, it's most of that's genetically modified. If you can find, you know, organically grown soy and they can guarantee it's non-GMO, which I don't think is almost impossible these days, then in moderation, it's okay. But soy is a phytoestrogen, just like red wine is. So men out there especially, you don't want to eat a lot of soy, you don't want to drink a lot of red wine. Women maybe, but not men, because it's going to lower your testosterone and raise your estrogen levels. And you don't want that. Men don't want that.
Right. I've seen a lot of men doing the wine tasting. That explains a lot.
Yeah, remember, everything in moderation. A little Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir has the highest amount of resveratrol, which is very good for the retina. All right. But these are patients with macular degeneration that are 85 years old, and they're probably not, you know, ravaging a 30-year-old woman. They're probably not having a lot of sex, and they're certainly not going to have any more children. So, you know, if you're going to have something that raises your estrogen, lowers your testosterone, if you don't want to go blind, that's a different story. But for most men, virile men, you know, a little wine in moderation is okay. If you're going to drink it, drink a Pinot Noir from the northern region of either New York or Oregon. That has the highest amount of resveratrol. But remember, everything in moderation. A good beer is probably better for you than wine. They add a lot of sulfites to the wines these days, too. If you get them from Europe, it's different. They're not adding additional sulfites. Sulfites occur naturally in the wine. We don't have to add more. The FDA makes us add way too much. That's one reason you get headaches. You know, you have five or six glasses of wine, and you're feeling no pain, and then you wake up in the morning, you have one of the worst headaches. It's the sulfites preserving your brain.
Yeah. See, I get migraines, so that was one of my triggers. And like when I go home and Portugal and France, where my mom and dad live, I never have an issue with that at all. But here, I mean, there's certain wines now. Yeah, it's obviously getting more progressive in the stores. But yeah,
I find a good organic wine that says no added sulfites on it. Very difficult to find. Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to wrap up with some questions. You've been very, very generous with your time, and we need to get out there and do some preparations for this hurricane. So very first question, is there a book that you recommend to people? It can be about this, or it can be about something completely different, or a fiction.
Wow. A book. Somebody asked me that and I was being interviewed before. I just, you know, I don't have a lot of time to read. I haven't read a lot of books. I mean, because I've been working literally since, you know, college started. And since I work, I'm 18, 19 hours a day, sleep deprived. I read a lot of journals, right, that are directly related to the businesses that I'm in. I think people that have the time and the ability to sit down and read a book by candlelight, very relaxing. You know, if you want to fall asleep, War and Peace, right? Sit down and try to read War and Peace, candlelight. I guarantee you'll get tired and you'll fall asleep.
Yeah, or any college textbook. All right, so what about a movie and or documentary?
Wow. My favorite movie. I tell you, one of my favorite movies, it was a long time ago, was The Champ. It, you know, and the reason for that is, you know, I people say I'm not that sensitive, but I actually, nobody knows this, but I actually cried in that movie. It's the only movie ever in my life that I shed a few tears. And The Champ was a long time ago. You can probably rent it and look at it, but it really got to my sensitive side. It's the only movie ever.
Oh, really?
I like Gladiator, too. Gladiator's a great movie.
That was, yeah. I cry like a little girl in a lot of movies, so I guess I don't have the same problem. all right, so what do you do? I mean, like you said it yourself, you work very hard. You've poured yourself into not just this business, but multiple businesses. So what do you do to decompress?
Well, I try to get to the gym every day, if I can, every night at least. And usually it's working out later in the evening or early in the morning. And then try to get some cardiovascular exercise, usually on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. I try to bike 50 miles on each of those days, or row. So I'm either biking, doing some form of, you know, fairly extreme cardiovascular exercise, hit the gym. And then every other weekend, I'm racing cars now. So I'm actually SCCA, full competition license. I'm driving a 2017 Viper ACR Extreme Voodoo 2. There's only 31 of them in the world. I put Michelin slicks and some headers and did a little engine work. And you know, racing in the advanced class and doing quite well. Just won the class at Sebring last Saturday and heading to New Orleans to race. I got to tell you, and there is one thing about releasing adrenaline. When you release adrenaline, you also release beta endorphins. Beta endorphins are natural pain relievers, natural antidepressants. And I tell you, when I have a need for speed. That's why I did the whole motocross thing. And until racing cars, I couldn't find a sport that really released the adrenaline, made me feel young, and made me feel good. I mean, golf doesn't do it for me. Fishing doesn't do it for me. Mountain biking does a little bit. Road biking definitely doesn't do it for me. Triathlons don't do it for me. But I noticed when I was driving my car on the streets too fast on the interstate, on the verge when you're waiting for the blue lights behind you, that did it. And so you can't really do that on the street. So I went to one of the track days at Sebring and got really interested into it. And then I took the Bondurant Race School courses over in Arizona and did Formula One race cars. And I got addicted to it about 4 or 5 months ago. And so that need for speed's coming out. But, I mean, after I'm in a race, I feel I get out of the car. I don't feel 55. I don't have knee aches and neck pains. I literally feel 21, 22 years of age. And I think everybody needs to find a way to help release their beta endorphins. You know, it's like when you're running and you hit that wall, okay? When you hit that wall and you run a little bit more, then boom, you start feeling good again. That most people don't get to the wall. But, you know, people that do marathons, they understand this, and triathletes and Ironman competitors, because that's the release of beta endorphins. And everybody needs to figure out a way, especially as you get older, how can they release the beta endorphins safely?
Yeah. Well, we've narrowed our field so much as far as safety as well. We're in this comfortable little box. And I think a lot of people that I've interviewed that have you know, broken out of that have had, you know, success and happiness and all these other areas. Because you think about original man, we weren't sitting in a climate controlled box watching electrical devices all day. We were out, you know, running for our lives and hunting and fishing and swimming and running and all these other things.
Enduring storms.
Right. Yeah. So I think that, I mean, it makes perfect sense. Martial arts is mine. You know, having someone trying to knock me out is kind of adrenaline rush too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right. So my next question is kind of a new one I started asking. Can you think of a person who would be an invaluable guest on this podcast to talk to first responders of the world?
I tell you, if my dad wasn't 89 years old, my dad would have been great. He's been a guest on my radio show many times. I got to tell you, my success is directly related to my dad. You know, he taught me the value of hard work, right? You know, you don't get anything for free. No matter what you do, he didn't push me into medicine. You know, he said, whatever you do, you know, do the best job. If you dig in a ditch, be the best ditch digger, and you're going to own the company. And I think my dad instilled moral values in me and work ethics that, quite frankly, I don't see these days in employees. So, yeah, but he's living in Mississippi, half in New Orleans. It'd be difficult to get him here. But if I had to pick somebody, it'd be, you know, my mentor is my dad. And he's probably one of the reasons I'm where I'm at today is because of the values that he instilled in me.
Brilliant. Okay, I love that answer. All right, so to wrap it up then, so people listening now, where can they find you? Where can they find the Fortify products, everything that we've talked about today?
Right, so the Lang Eye Institute is based in the center of Florida in the Villages. You can learn a lot more about what we do at drmichaellang.com. Don't spell doctor, just D-R, drmichaellang.com. That actually will link up to a section social media. You can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, Google+, LinkedIn, Instagram from drmichaellang.com. And that will also link you up to my other companies. Fortify Vitamins, which is fortify.com, F-O-R-T-I-F-E-Y-E. You can learn about the research behind the products that we've developed, a whole line of whole body supplements, not just eye vitamins. Paleo Simplified is a company of mine where we make paleo bars, paleo granola. That's from the website Blue Light Defense and a few other companies, all link from drmichaellang.com. So pretty much that website will also give you some videos of me racing, or you can go to two YouTube channels, which I think are also on that website, either Dr. Michael Lang YouTube or Ocular Health Channel YouTube. And that got a lot of videos of my radio shows and also of me recumbent biking or car racing, even some motocross videos.
Okay. And what's the radio show called?
Ask the Doctor. I've been hosting Ask the Doctor since March of 1993, nonstop.
Wow. A little bit longer than me. I'm hitting 10 months right now. All right. Well, thank you so much. I think we've really delved into some things that, and I love podcasts and I delve into a lot of fitness and health. We just don't discuss a lot of things that we talked about today. I haven't heard anything talked about with the A2 milk and you know, right, many of the areas. So it's definitely going to be another gold mine, I think, for people. So I really appreciate you giving me the time, especially at the end of your work day here. We're sitting here and it's dark outside now. So thank you so much.
Fantastic. I enjoyed it. Anytime you want to do it again, just let me know. I'll always be available for you.
Brilliant. Well, thank you.
All right.